Hello, I'm Rachel Richards, former BBC correspondent, parenting coach, mother of two teenagers and two older stepdaughters.
Hi, I'm Susie Asley, mindfulness coach and mother of three teenagers, two of them are twins.
Susie, do you swear or cuss, as they call it in America?
Yep, I do.
Okay, were you ever threatened with having your mouth washed out with soap?
Yes, as a child I was. It didn't happen, but I was threatened with it.
I don't know if it's true around the world. I wonder what other cultures would threaten with children where they think that they're not showing enough respect.
Yeah, it's probably abuse, isn't it?
Well, Claudia wants to know what to do when your teen swears at you and calls you a bitch. So we'll talk more about swearing later, including what the most popular swear words are, the science of swearing, and how we should respond as parents. But first, Susie, imposter syndrome is a real problem for some parents, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm bringing it up because Mike has posted a review of our lovely podcast. Thank you, Mike. And it was on LinkedIn. And he says, as a single parent who regularly suffers from imposter syndrome, these podcasts are essential listening and fun and enjoyable as well. Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you very much.
We really appreciate it. We love it. We love a good review. So thank you for that. So it's lovely to get a review from a father. I've been raving about the book It's a Good Time to Be a Girl by Helena Morrissey, who's an immensely successful businesswoman with a husband at home doing the work to keep her large family going. And I think it's really important that we have visible male role models who are playing active roles as parents. What do you think, Susie?
Yeah, massively important for our boys. I think when they're younger, most of their caregivers are, you know, in schools and wherever they are female. Not all of them. I mean, a lot of schools have lots of male teachers now, but I think the proportion is still women.
Yeah, I remember you saying before that you struggled with, you know, that you were on your own.
Yes.
And you were looking for people.
Yes, I actively looked, especially for my eldest, because I was, you know, parenting on my own, and they do see their dad, but it's not very often. And looking for male role models, male figures that they can mirror. They need it. They really need it. I really struggled with that.
In episode 10, we talked about teenage friendship groups, mostly from the viewpoint of girls. And it was hugely popular and something many parents have struggled with. So we've now been asked by our listener, Sarah, to talk about why boys are so mean to each other. Now, obviously, she's got a perspective because mm-hmm. she's had problems with male friendship groups. And I've heard from quite a few parents about how difficult it can be. Susie, you have two. I have none. I like boys, but I don't have any.
No.
And I have friends who've got all boys in their family, and I love the energy in their house, but it does feel very different from mine.
It's very different. I mean, boys are very different. I have a sister, and so having boys was like, oh, I don't know how to do that. And just from a very early age, they are very different. They interact very differently. Obviously, massively stereotyping, there are boys who are, you know, it's a massive stereotype. But in my family, even when they were little, and I have twins, I have boy-girl twins. So it was really fun to see the difference. So from an early age, my boy twin would be like picking up toys to try and fix them or to drive them and look at how the wheels are working. And my daughter would be picking up the ones with faces and, you know, interacting and making stories. So from a really early age, there's a huge difference. And I think as teenagers, there is still differences. There are, you know, massively common traits of humanity as well, obviously. But the way they interact with their friends is really different. And my boys are very different in personality and in nature, and the way they have friends is very different too. But I think generally, in my experience, their friendships are activity based. So, you know, kick a football around, you'll go and do something together, a game together, do something together. Whereas girls, they seem to hang out in a different way. It's a different focus somehow.
It's a very interesting topic because we are having a lot of debate at the moment about, you know, the difference between boys and girls and how there isn't that much difference when people look at the underpinning psychology and the way their brains work. And the truth is, though, that we are nurtured as well as a genetic imprint. Yeah. And it's very hard to unpick exactly what's going on there. What I will say is that I saw a headline in UK Men's Health magazine saying a third of men have no close friends, with peak loneliness occurring at the age of 35. Now, obviously, nobody wants this scenario. This is not healthy for society. It's not good for the men that end up in this situation. And I thought it was a good place to start, just because then we could sort of roll the clock back and say, well, so what was going on earlier in their lives where they just weren't able to form these close friendships,
yeah.
or maybe that they just didn't see them as important. There's an amazing woman called Niobe Way. Her name popped up everywhere. And she spent decades studying boys' friendship groups during adolescence. Now, this was in America, although curiously, she had a cohort in China.
Mm-hmm.
So very, very different culture.
Yeah.
And I think that the culture does have an impact to an extent, just because, for example, when I went traveling around India as a teenager, backpacking with my girlfriend, I was really struck by how men and young men, just men generally, would walk around holding hands. This is not something we do in England or America. So there are strong cultural differences in different countries.
Yeah, I lived in Denmark for years, and I think the culture with men is different there as well. I haven't lived there for quite a few years now, so I don't know how it is right now. But my memory is that, you know, men talk more about feelings. I think we're quite traditional here still.
Interesting. Way says that 85% of the American boys she interviewed over the past 20 plus years suggest that their closest relationships, especially during early and middle adolescence, share the plot of love story more than the plot of, say, Lord of the Flies. And the problem is we get the impression that boys are quite Lord of the Flies because if that's the sort of cultural information we've been getting from that particular book, but all sorts of other things.
Yeah, that's not my experience with my boys, and they're very different with their friendships. So my eldest is he has a handful of close friends, and my younger is we call him party boy at home at the moment. There's a constant stream of friends through the house, which I love, is brilliant. But he's still, you know, they don't seem to have that. They all seem really, really nice to each other.
Which is,
I mean,
just
banter
brilliant.
And all of that. And
yeah.
There's a lot of humour. I think maybe the difference, I mean, my daughter laughs with her friends too, but it seems to be different. There's a lot of banter and humour seems to be, you know, social capital. If you're funny, you're an important member of the group more than with girls, I think.
Although my girls say that that's actually really important. They need to be funny. They need to be funny. But here's the problem. Things start to fall apart when they're hit by media messages of masculine expectations. I mean, she tells a story of how seventh grade boys at a New York City academy sniggered when she told them about a teen who loved his best friend. Her response was, well, what would you say if I told you that about 85% of boys feel this way about a friend during their teen years? And one boy said, what, for real? And she said, yeah, boys want close friendships where they can share their secrets. And what happened then was she'd given them permission and they to be that this was normal. And it changed the relationship in the room and everybody started being more open about their feelings. So in many ways, it's about normalizing this, you know, emotional life that boys have. They need to be given permission at a young age to have these conversations and for it to be socially acceptable. Because I think we all, girls and boys, because I don't think they're different in this respect, when they hit adolescence, they're hit with all these emotions and these new ways of having to relate to each other. And they need the language for it.
Yes.
And they also think they're weird.
Yeah, they use the wrong language. And I've heard it so many times, you know, I think it's a fear of intimacy. Like what you're describing, like if boys are suddenly seen to be close, that's a bit of a, oh, is that okay? Is that not okay? So we better
they need to distance themselves from that.
It's the fear of the intimacy for some reason.
Yes.
And if we can normalize it, like you're saying from this lady in the book, then I think that's really, really important for them.
Yes. And what she found was that there is a man box, just like you have a girl box, you know, where we talked about in the girlfriendship groups that they have a beauty pageant and they're all entered into it. They don't have any choice about it. The boys are all entered into this man box. So when there's a group and it's defined by the strong boy in the group, you know, you have to fit into that. Otherwise, you're not in the group. Mm. And there's a general man box. And we all know what's probably in that man box, right? You're tall, good looking, strong, you know, and
Sporty,
funny. And if you don't fit into one of those things, you've got a bit of a problem.
Yeah, I think that it's changed a bit. I mean, I totally recognise that. I think it's shifting a bit that there seems to be sort of alternative men boxes. and they can look a bit different and you can be in that as well. But so it's not as black and white, but there is still a tendency to be, if you're sporty, you're naturally cool.
Yes, and what she found was that this sporty, so this switch where boys go from this very intimate, happy, comfortable relationship, she found it tends to happen around the age of 15 and on, where they've suddenly gone through this phase of adolescence and they're now uncomfortable. Am I being too intimate with this person? And she said that it's very protective if they are in the man box. Those boys are allowed to be more comfortable with discussing their emotions, and the ones who are on slightly on the outside feel less safe.
Yeah, and they don't know how. They don't know what to do or how to do it. It's just awkward, so they don't do it, and then they just muck about instead.
And that's such a great point, because there is a listening project which was set up by Nairobi Way at New York University, and her co-creator is called Joseph Derek Nelson, both of whom are trying to challenge these stereotypes that boys feel they have to fit into. And what they're doing there is they're trying to teach boys how to be curious about each other. So you don't have to keep saying, how are you feeling? Or it's more about, you know, what did you think about this? Oh, you thought that. And then how do you ask a deep question that then probes their thinking? Mm. How do you, and actually this improves relationships full stop, right? Because, you know, often my husband will go out with his friend and I'll say, so how was it? And he goes, yeah, it's great, it's great. And yeah. I say, so, you know, he's going through a divorce. How is he? And he goes, oh, I don't know.
Yeah. So
which
weird.
Is not very helpful, because surely if he can't ask his friends or can't talk to his friends about it, who is he talking to about it?
Exactly.
Do we need to buy counsellors for everything?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think also I experience with my boys and with friends as well is there are different feelings that are more or less acceptable for boys and girls. Like anger still seems to be acceptable. You know, if you're angry as a boy, then that's okay. That's
frustration.
Right. Yeah,
yes.
You can go and kick something or punch a wall. Whereas, you know, for girls, anger is seen as, oh, you know, she was a bit feisty, wasn't she? Still, I think, you know, it is changing, thank goodness. And I don't know what to call them, but, you know, the softer feelings, the softer emotions are still seen as something boys would rather not express. Mm. Very generally, that is shifting, I think.
Yes.
But there is still a difference there.
I think it's only shifting because there are people actively like Nairobi Way and her cohort actively trying to push against it. And I saw an amazing piece, I forget the name of the man, I saw him on Twitter, and he was talking about how when he saw some of her work, he read her book, something went off inside him, and he just realized how he'd been manipulated by society to think a certain way and behave a certain way, and how punishing it was for him as a human being.
Yeah.
So it's not amazing. Something we want. Yeah.
No, because anger, even looking on that level, if we look at anger being an acceptable emotion, it's a secondary emotion. So anger is a response or a reaction to something that is, you know, further down. Maybe that's sadness or pain or, you know, something that is maybe not something they want to express immediately. So, you know, it's really important that they're allowed to, or they feel able to express all of it.
Mm. There are two really great things I would urge people to watch if this is a subject that touches them. One is The Mask You Live In, which I came across because of this research. And they use it in this program in New York to help boys just get a sense of what it is that's being just thrown at them by the media. And it's things like man up, you know, grow a pair, all the little, and it's the same stuff I was talking about with social media with our girls, where I constantly will mention things I see on Instagram, on Facebook, or, you know, in films. And there's this one wonderful woman, La La La, let me explain, who will pick out these things, which we don't notice until she says, have you noticed this?
Yes.
And I think we need to do this with boys too. Mm. We need to say, did you see what that they just said there?
Yes.
How does that make you feel? Do you feel that that's true and that men need to be like that? Are adolescent boys really like that?
Yeah, that's really
and
important.
Give them the chance to sort of reflect on whether they're being given messages that aren't helpful.
Yeah.
And talk about how they relate to that. And I think that gives them, that gives you a window into being able to, and say, look, don't you feel manipulated?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm going to use that. I'm going to have a look at that, because it's really, really important for them to reflect upon what it is they're taking in.
These
and
subliminal messages.
What they actually think about all these things, because we don't even know if we don't know exactly.
If you don't think about it, exactly. And I know I was quite sexist growing up. unwittingly, because I was growing up in an environment that was very sexist. And it slowly took me time to unpack an awful lot of the things I'd been told were right and just were actual biases.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about my own boys. I mean, I don't experience with them, which is really lovely. And having this conversation is making me think about how they are. They do seem to really care about their friends. And I don't know what conversations they have, because obviously I'm not allowed in them. But there does seem to be this kind of a care about it, which is really lovely. But I have said to mine, because I think with boys we have to be really careful, because they tend to generally not speak. And that awful statistic you gave at the beginning of, you know, that they don't have close friends, a lot of them. And we know the health consequences that can have later in life. You know, the suicide rates for boys are horrific. For men, you know, it's the biggest, I think it's the biggest killer of in that in an age bracket. I think it's 25 to something. Mm. I mean, it's horrific. Mm. And, you know, loneliness plays a huge role in that. And friends, you know, counteract that. So, you know, keeping an eye on their friends, especially in lockdown, yes, you know, keeping really an eye, because it's really quick. I think girls, you see, and this is massive generalization, but you tend to see a sort of a deterioration, a sort of a shutting down, not always, but generally. And boys, it can be really quick. You know, and because they often, I mean, my eldest does, you know, shuts himself away in games. I don't really know what's going on in there. But if I can hear him laughing and mucking about, it's probably all right.
Yes.
But, you know, keeping an eye on them, because it can be really quick from feeling okay to not feeling okay and then to feeling really not okay. Mm. So, you know, keep an eye on your mates.
Yeah, I love that. I love that message, because actually what you're doing is, rather than saying how are you feeling, encouraging them to use those words to help their mates.
Yeah.
And that's a very, that's actually a position of power. If you're helping your friend, it gives you a sense of ownership on it. And that's a really good point. So what can we do as parents? One of the ways into this is talking about sports and intimacy, because sports is a really big bonding experience for most boys. And, you know, when they help their friend if they're struggling with, you know, passing or any of those things, you frame it and say, look, that's brilliant that you're prepared, you know, you've noticed a weakness in your friend, you're supporting them. Mm. You can actually just use sports to and say, hey, it's great to be able to hug.
Or the non-sporty boys they have, you know, there's the sporty boys and then there's the, you know, the geeks, which they call themselves, you know, the computer guys, of which mine is one of. And they have their own, you know, way of bonding, but that's also bonding. It's really important.
Teaching them how to recognize their friends' boundaries. I mean, boys love banter, but they need to start to understand the difference between ribbing and hurting.
Yes.
And this is one of the ways in which things can tip into, you know, and that's literally a flip, isn't it? You know, it's a switch, and it can go from them having a great time to the boy feeling like he's been destroyed.
Yes.
And so it's about talking to them about, did you notice what happened there? You know, when would you stop? Yeah. How do you recognize when your mate's had enough?
Yeah.
Getting them to think it through before it becomes a problem.
Because they can be brutal. I mean, I've seen it. And they're really funny. Like, they're really funny.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
And that has so much weight. Yes. You know, that the funny guy is, you know, we want to hear from the funny guy, but they can, you know, they can be brutal.
Yes.
They need to be really aware of that.
Yes. And if they do cry, capitalizing on those moments, saying you're feeling a strong emotion right now, and you probably go out of your way to hide it. That's okay. You know, good for you. Just give yourself some space. And
it's a release.
Exactly. Giving them an emotional vocabulary so that they can recognize, because we've been talking about lots of these things, and we've talked about it with girl friendships and we've talked about it with self-harm, and so often the reason they end up down these horrible alleyways is they don't know how to express, or they can't shape their emotions or frame them, and they don't know how to express them and say, I'm struggling with this, or and they can't even talk to themselves about it, so they just find another outlet.
Yeah, I've tried to talk. I remember talking to a boy who I knew really well, you know, how's he doing? I could see there was something that was up, and I tried on various occasions, and because he wasn't used to that language or used to that, you know, it was almost like, what are you doing? Like, why would I answer that? Or, you know, kind of rolling eyes, you know, please leave this space. So it's really, if they don't have that language at all, it's quite hard to get in.
Yeah. But they notice it.
Yes.
And completely different story. But when I was a teenager, I went to stay at a girl's house, and this happened to be a regular thing because my parents couldn't get me or wouldn't get me to a thing I wanted to go to. And I very specifically remember sitting around the table and the father turning to me and saying, "How was your day?" And I nearly fainted because I'd never had a man, an older man, ask me that question. In fact, my mother never asked me that question either. But it was mostly that I was shocked that he'd even noticed that I was at the table. And the point being that I didn't talk to anybody about it. I didn't really even think a huge amount about it at that moment. But it had a massive impact on me because it made me see that there were different ways of having relationships. So if you have that conversation, if you, whether a woman or a man, can actually just give them the chance to see that there is a different way of relating, it can have the most extraordinary impact that you may never see.
Yes, you're sowing a seed that there are other options of being in the world. You can be different. Yeah, that's really important.
And being physically demonstrative. I mentioned this before where my ex-boyfriend's dad used to hold his hand. And I know that your son doesn't like that, but I'm hoping the police aren't listening. But I do drive holding my daughter's hand when we're going really slowly. But she loves it. She wants that contact. That's likes, and that's not the same necessarily with boys. But what we need to recognize is that when boys are going through this phase, they may be really hunched over and not, you know, the language, body language may be wrong. But actually, to keep trying.
And just like a pat on the back. I mean, that sounds a bit weird, but just I have two boys and one of them is really huggy and physical. So that's cool. The other one is really not. So, you know, I just touch his back as I'm walking past or, you know, his arm or something if we're cooking or, you know, just a little thing. And that's connection too. He doesn't have to give me a full on hug, although I do kind of encourage that.
You can try, keep the door open. And you know, we have to respect that some people don't like that.
Absolutely. But you can connect in other tiny ways, and that actually they make a big difference. Yeah, I think it's also really important that when our boys bring their friends home, that they feel comfortable at home. And I think my experience, and it might be different for other boys, is they're a bit different from girls at home, and they find any. Well, depending on the boy, but you have to be careful that you're not mothering them.
Interesting.
And if I go to mine, you know, "Oh, have you done your homework?" Or, you know, just, you know, I mean, my kids are fine and their friends are really lovely. I really like their friends. So I actually have to kind of try and not just sit and chat with their friends because that's just weird. But they're really nice. But that is something that maybe would make them not want to hang out in the home.
Sure.
And I think it's really important that they have spaces they can hang out in and be in a home and feel comfortable there. And also, you know, the classic, and that applies to girls as well, if they, you know, other people's parents can give something, a different dynamic to the child. And then, you know, your parents might be fine, but they also might not have a mother who's particularly understanding or a father who's there. So going into somebody else's home can be a really lovely experience for them. But kind of leave them alone a bit, you know, just give them the pizzas and go
depart.
I'm really bad at that. I like chatting to them. But it's they still seem to feel safe anyway.
Yes.
But you know, don't mother them.
Yeah, love that. I love that. Finally, really coaching them in ways of being assertive and savvy without responding with aggression. So I was listening to a chap called Lennox Rogers from a crime prevention organisation, Refocus, and he said that when they look at the instances in which adolescents use knives, so many of them are triggered by small events. And we need our boys to be given other ways of communicating and understanding their emotions so that they can control them better and deal with difficult situations without stabbing somebody. And, you know, it's not always easy because I remember another friend's son going through, you know, episodic bullying, and the response of the men in his life were, well, you know, basically you need to get him in the canteen where there are lots of other kids, punch him on the nose, make sure it makes them cry, and keep going until he's on the ground, and you will be punished by the teachers, but he won't touch you again.
Wow. Do we not have any alternatives to that?
I listened to this and I thought, really? Have we not moved on from this at all?
Some people would still say that, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, they do. My husband says that.
Yeah.
So, and I think we need to try and give, you know, other alternatives.
Yeah. And I think the main thing is for teenagers is, you know, the big word, normalizing.
Yeah.
They want to be the same as everybody else. They want to belong. And if they think everybody is doing it this way, then they will do that too. Mm. If they think everybody is cool with their mates and is talking about stuff, they might actually try it. You know, it's the getting the norm to change a bit in their eyes.
And it's easier with some kids than others. Absolutely. Because, you know, one of my daughters is totally cool with who she is and doesn't really care what other people say. The other one just tells me, you know, back off. You don't understand. This is how teenagers are. And you just have to keep going.
Yeah. And model it, isn't it? And then talk to them. But, you know, as we've talked about many times, in short bursts, I have my timer of 2 minutes when I'm talking to my boys, if I want to say something particular, because they glaze over after sentence four, you know, just little things like that. And, you know, mirror picking up on, oh, that must feel like this if they say something, instead of going in, how do you feel about that? What are you feeling? Because they just roll their eyes. Ugh.
And I've just suddenly thought, I have been obsessively listening to a podcast called Diary of a CEO. Mm-hmm. And it's, I've now forgotten the name of the person who does it, but he is very in contact with his feelings about work and about, you know, people running companies. And he's fascinating to listen to because he interviews all these different people, like the guy who set up Strava. Mm. And so young adolescent boys will listen to something like this if you give it to them. And because it's fascinating seeing the inside workings of somebody who's an entrepreneur, but he goes right back to their childhoods. Mm. And it gives you such a wonderful opportunity to let them hear somebody who's very successful talk about their own feelings and thoughts and how their childhood shaped them. And I love something like that. I think it's very helpful for teenagers.
There's a brilliant lady. I read her book and listened to it, I think, on Audible a few years ago, Maggie Dent. And she talks about raising boys. She had four boys. I can't remember the name of the book. I can find it and put it in the notes. And she gives lots of little tips and ideas. And actually, one of hers was, you know, boys might not want to hug, but, you know, just touch them as you're going past, or, you know, that kind of little things to, because they need connection.
We all do. We're human beings. We need it. Have your sons managed to sustain those close friendships as they grew up, or have you noticed that familiar pattern where their friends drop away? It's never too late to talk about connectedness, and there is so much supporting a new way of looking at masculinity now. You can post any comments on our Facebook group or Instagram, or just email us at help@teenagersuntangled.com. Now, Susie, Claudia wants to know what to do when your teen swears at you and calls you a bitch. I mean, I asked my daughter about the word, and she said she and her girlfriends often use it as in, hey, bitch, I got my bitches, but oh, you bitch. But it's the context.
You do that really well.
I think I could pass as a 14-year-old girl, no problem. But before we go on, quick fire question. Are there some words that are definitely more offensive than others?
Yes.
Is it less offensive if you are writing the word, if you don't spell the whole word out or use an acronym like WTF?
I think so, yeah.
Does it make a difference who uses the swear word?
As to how strong it is, you mean?
Whether it's offensive?
Yeah, I think it does, actually.
What's peak swear word age?
Oh, I don't know. 17, 16?
It's in their 20s, early 20s. But yes, we'll sort of cover the other things as we go along. We had a couple of listener responses. Sarah says she swears in front of her kids, but it's never about anyone. You know, it's not specific. She doesn't allow them to swear in general conversation, but gets that they will swear with their friends and in text messages. Vicky thinks it's generally more common nowadays. She deals with teens who are in a foster situation, and they may have come from a household where it's really commonplace. Mm. So she doesn't bother picking them up on it unless it's really excessive, or, you know, it's about someone else or against someone. She says swearing at someone is about an attitude towards them, and she would definitely challenge that.
Mm. Yeah.
So, swear words. So we've got this fantastic English language. I'm sure you've Danish language. Is that how much, you know, is there a lot of swearing in Danish?
Yeah, there is. It's really different in Denmark. They swear more, I think. I mean, I haven't lived there for a few years, but my memory of it is children would swear more, and they would use the English words. I won't say them here. And they would put, you know, have a Danish accent. Ah. And they're just less strong in a foreign
language.
But
then what's the point?
Well, because you're still having that release.
Okay.
And they think the English words are cool as well. Of course. So they would say them and they would use them quite young more. When I lived there, I would swear occasionally in Danish, but using my own language was way more, felt much better.
Very good point. And in fact, studies have shown that swearing in your original language is much more useful and powerful.
Yeah.
It has all the beneficial sides to it.
There was one I'd use in Danish, but it was like starting with an F, so it just felt really good. Fensos.
Shall we ask what that means? No, maybe not. So in the English language, we have, you know, the A word, the B word, the C word, the F word, the S word, the T word, the W word, lots of words, right? And what I think is really interesting is when I've been talking to one particular mother whose daughter had used a word to describe another girl in a text. And when she was talking to me about it, she actually said, well, it wasn't, when the mother accused her, she said, well, it wasn't that word, it was this word, mm-hmm. and that's a less offensive word than that word.
Okay.
and I just thought, how interesting that actually that's the issue, you know, is it the word, the specific word you use, or is it the context you use it in? What actually really are we talking about here?
Yeah, I don't know. I think the key of it is, because we swear in our house, we do. And
tut, tut. Lots of clean mouths in your house.
No, really not. And mine are a bit older now. But the context is really important. So we have like a jokey way of swearing. I think the key is we have that, and that's my personal boundaries. I'm okay with that. And they know that, but I've also said to them, don't do this in other contexts, because, you know, people genuinely take offense at swearing and there's no judgment in that. You know, it's just different ways of being in the world with everything. And if you go out and you swear, then you might really offend somebody. So don't do that. But in this space here, it's, you know, we can muck about with it. That's
well,
fine.
The interesting thing is swear words by their very nature are supposed to be offensive, because if they're not offensive, they're not swear words.
Yes.
But what you've done is created a haven at home where they can be completely relaxed using words that might are verboten in other places, but they can just use them at will.
Yes. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But with an awareness that, you know, if you do this in other places, people might be offended, and they, you know, that's okay for them to be offended. You know, you don't need to think that they're daft or, you know, you're better because you swear. You know, that's ridiculous. It's just a different way of being.
Yes. So what is a swear word? Mm-hmm. So there's a philosopher, Rebecca Roach. There are people who are specialists in this. They dedicate their lives to swear words. She says they need to cause offence. Mm-hmm. So really, those words aren't swear words when they're used in your house, because they don't cause offence. So what you're doing is you're just banter. You're just the kind of part of your family banter. Right.
Oh, interesting. I mean, they kind of do, but it's in a jokey way. Yeah. Interesting. But
they're there to vent emotion. Around the world, swear words tend to cluster around certain topics. We've got laboratorial matters, sex and religion. Religion used to be very strong. It may well still be in places like America where there are very strong religious feelings. In the UK, people have shifted quite a long way from religion, religious traditions. So those are much less potent.
Yes.
Swear words are taboo breaking for the sake of being taboo breaking. And the whole point is you're not supposed to use them, and they exist to break rules.
Yes. Mm. Oh, that's
really interesting. But what I think you're doing, this is complete speculation, is you are reinforcing your tribe, because your tribe is allowed to do this. This is the language of your tribe, and this is how you use things at home. But you say, well, if you go into a different tribe, you have to understand that that tribe may not accept this.
Yes, yes. I mean, we'll, you know, put the finger up at each other and regularly as a kind of mucking about thing. But they also know that if they were to come up to me and you know, swear at me seriously, and one of them has done that, that's not okay.
Interesting.
And
yes.
I told him so. And
yes. And how did that go down? What did you say?
I said, don't ever speak to me like that again. And that is completely unacceptable. Do you hear me?
What was his response?
I heard a grunty sort of, all right, sorry.
But he apologised.
I think so, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay. It's quite a long time ago. Yeah, no, that was a, you know, he crossed a line.
Yes, that's very
because of the intent, the intention behind the swearing.
It's the intention. It's the context. It's intention. So the uses of swear words. So why are we doing this? I mean, apart from trying to cause offence, there are other things that come up with this. Now, for start, the word, for example, in terms of effluvia, shit is worse than piss.
Okay.
So there is a kind of, there's a grade. And if you say spit, that's not a swear word. Okay. But these are all bodily, you know, right?
Bodily fluids.
So it's really interesting that there is a kind of grade of what's a swear word and what isn't. I'm sorry if I've offended anyone by using these words. But anyway, why are we doing this apart from these releasing these taboos? There is an emotional release which can mitigate pain. Now, what researchers have found is that it's easier to keep your arm in an ice cold water for longer if you're swearing the whole time. So it does actually have, so if you're feeling really bad, try going into a room and swearing. You may find it actually helps, whether it's both psychological and physical pain. Yeah, this is found to help.
Distraction, isn't it? Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. And as you said, it's doing it in your first language. Don't bother with the second language. It's no use.
Does not have the same effect.
No. And the claim has been made that, swearing is a way of bonding. So as I was saying, that actually when you have teenagers who are swearing, you know, these parents who said, oh, well, I know that they're going to do it. Of course, it's great. That's great parenting because you understand that this is a way quite often where teenagers will have their own sort of words that they use to swear.
Mm.
And there was an awful incident on Big Brother in the UK many, many years ago where one of the contestants used the N-word.
Mm.
No, yeah. And she said, but we all use it. But she hadn't realized the extent to which it was a slur and utterly offensive to everybody else. And it was cringy because I just looked at this girl and thought, gosh, she was just ignorant.
Yes.
And this is a problem. So it's great if your kids bond together using these, but we have to say that's, you know, you have to understand, like you've said, there's a context.
Yes.
And you need to be multilingual. You need to know that you go into this setting. And and actually people are considered to be more trustworthy who swear.
It's really interesting. Mm. It's really interesting.
Because they're not filtering.
Yes. Yeah, there's an argument. I remember when my nephews were young in Denmark of you know, allowing them to swear, and there was discussions about it. And that was the idea, was that if they were not filtering, then they had better vocabulary. I have no idea if that was the case or not. Sounded quite good.
Well, I think we need to go through all the Shakespearean books and find some really good swear words. Yes. This is the thing.
Swear words.
Yes, come up with some interesting ones, and then you could be the next person.
Yeah, because you know when you try and find alternatives, don't you? I remember when my kids were little, and you know, I didn't want them, you know, swearing out in public when they were little because that's really bad for them. Mm. And trying to find alternative words, and they're just never as satisfying.
No, not because they don't perform the function.
No.
And it's interesting because one researcher has found that the most used word 20 years ago was bloody.
Yeah.
And that's changed.
Yes.
It's now the F word. And he says he thinks the reason for that, and he's actually trawled through thousands of hours of transcripts. So people are actually
amazing.
Doing this. So this is a job. He's found that the great thing with the F word is that it can be used as a suffix, or you know, you can add things to it in the same way that the shit word.
Yes.
So I'm not offended by that word, but maybe other people really are. But anyway, you know, and in Ireland, people often say, oh, you're such a gobshite.
Yes.
And it's not even considered to be that rude, but it's, I think it's as because it's connected with other words, and then you know, is it really a swear word? So there's a kind of like, what are we talking? What it's a swear word if it's offensive?
It's just all subjective, isn't it? You just have to have this awareness of what, you know. Ask yourself, what do I think is acceptable? You know, tell your family that these are the boundaries in this family if that's appropriate, and then give them an awareness that might not be the case in other areas, and if you kind of are worrying that they might not be able to control. I think by the time they get to teenagers, they are able to filter. Mm. You know, when they're little, maybe not, but they know they can. They you know, you see them all the time. They talk to their teacher in a different way. They talk to their mates. They know they know how
they're
to change language.
But one of the interesting ones for me is Taiwanese leader who used the F word on Twitter talking about the Chinese government.
Oops.
And yeah, there was a pile on. But he said, well, what else am I supposed to say to make them understand?
Oh,
right. So okay. You know, he said it's a very useful, effective way of showing hearing just how angry I am and how little I accept his viewpoint.
Interesting. And to get a lot of attention, I imagine.
And get a lot of attention, yes. And what's interesting is one study showed that swearing is still considered more offensive depending on the identity of the swearer. Now, if you're a woman, it's considered 6 times more obscene in this study than if you're a man.
Got it.
And there were similar amounts if you are from an ethnic minority. So actually, I think a lot of it is connected to power.
Yeah,
and if you're
so
in a working setting, you just because your CEO uses swear words, you're treading very carefully. If you start using swear words too, because you think, oh, he uses them, you need to be very careful.
Yeah,
because he may think, oh, that's great, or he may take offence.
Yeah, in a work setting, I think you have to be really careful because it sounds really offensive when it's used by someone in authority.
Yes, and it's confusing because my first boss was a fat Geordie, sweaty man who just swore, used the F word.
Lovely.
Every 3 words, it was the F word. And I thought, oh, is that how the Geordies speak? Wow. Yeah. I don't, you know, and I just assumed that maybe that's how Geordies spoke. I didn't know. But, and I sort of just had to accept it because he was my boss. And I didn't say, could you mind just toning it down a bit?
No. Not appropriate. No, I mean, I wouldn't swear in my workplace.
Never.
Context based, isn't it?
It's context based, yes. So, coming back to the question posed by Claudia, which is where her daughter had actually said to her, you know, called her a bitch. Mm. It's really interesting because there was one website I looked at, the Very Well Family, managing disrespectful teens. And they said, whatever the reason for swearing, it's clearly unacceptable. And you have to, you know, give them consequences for their inappropriate behavior, mm-hmm. take away privileges and assign extra chores. And I was interested in that because, you know, the truth is I have never had none of my children. So I've got 4. None of them have ever said anything like that to me.
No.
And I think part of it is our closeness. Part of it is that if they ever show me that, I think I've just always just used the stock phrase, don't be so ungrateful. If they complain about things that I think, and I think there's an element of them realizing, and I've told them about my past and how, you know, how much I work to make sure their life is great.
Mm.
And I think they wouldn't dare to say something like that to me because they know I'd be very offended.
Mm.
And I don't mind swearing at all. But I think if somebody said something like that to me and meant it, it would be very painful.
Yeah.
So I can understand how she would feel that much pain.
Yes. And so, yeah, some people, I mean, when my child swore at me in a serious way, that was totally different from the mucking about stuff. And I think we have to maybe not take it too seriously because maybe the child doesn't realise that it's causing such great offence. So you can have a great conversation, can't you? You know, when you say that, maybe you use that at home and maybe it's, not at home, maybe you use that with your mates or wherever you've heard it and it's not a big deal. But when you say that, that's really offensive to me and it's actually really hurtful. So please don't do that.
Mm.
And then maybe the kid doesn't even know that and goes, oh, well, you know, I'm sorry, I won't do that again.
Sure.
So that's kind of step one, isn't it? If you don't know you're offending someone, then,
yes.
then, you know, then it's very different. But if they do know they're offending, you know, that they're doing it deliberately, then having that conversation, which will be a different one, you know.
If they continue to be rude to you after that, what would you say their parent could do?
Well, it's not about the swear word then, is it? So the swear word is a signal, isn't like most things. The swear word, if they're deliberately doing it and they know that using that particular word offends you and is hurtful and they're using it anyway, then they're using the swear word as a signal that something is annoying them or something is up. Or and again, we don't have to, you know, we don't have to massively catastrophize it. It might just be a little thing they're really annoyed about, or there might be a, you know, a deeper thing going on, and investigating that with them. You know, we don't know what's going on. I notice you said that word, you know, it offends me. What's, you know, do you want to tell me what's going on? What's happening? Why are you so angry with me? And exploring
so
it, investigating.
So rather than going straight to punishment, actually trying to unpack exactly what's going on, because it is a signal.
Yeah. And then if you are really offended by the particular swear word, you know, if you feel that's appropriate, you know, if you use that again, then, and you feel you want to do it that way, then that would be a way. But that I would say, if they're deliberately using that swear word and they know it's offending you, there's a reason behind it.
But also, like, why is it so offensive to me?
Yes, yeah. Check using it as an opportunity to you know, why is that particular word really triggering me? Mm. And then you might, you know, investigate that and find out, yes, it is really triggering, I won't have it. That's fine. That's your boundary. Or that it might be a really good opportunity to have a look at, maybe there's something else going on there for you. It's always, you know, when we get triggered, whatever the trigger, it's always an opportunity to investigate it and learn a bit more about ourselves.
Yeah, love it. Keep learning. We're parenting ourselves, aren't we?
Yeah.
So are you a swearer or a saint? We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, we all know where I am in that, don't we?
I'd like everyone who's a saint to put their hand up. We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or help@teenagersuntangled.com. In our next episode, is your child rude and disrespectful to you whilst being an angel with the other parent? Mm. So it's kind of similar, but it's not.
Yes,
we're moving into this because I have seen a lot of mothers getting very cross and upset about this, and I'm sure this happens to fathers too. But I think quite often it's the mother, it's the that dynamic where the girl is quite... she just gravitates towards her father because maybe her father's not the person doing it. Anyway, let's talk about this.
Interesting, yeah.
And so what would you do about it? Let us know if you have any answers or you've dealt with this. We'd love to hear how you've changed things, turned things around, or whether you just want to vent. Tell us what your problems are. Yes. Also, should we allow our teens to choose their hairstyle or their clothes? Or tattoos? Where do we draw the line, and at what age?
Oh, I'm looking forward to this.
Yes, because I mean, if you're saying yes, they can have a tattoo, what age? Well, you said 18. Okay. Yeah. That's it for now. Don't forget to subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. Review us so that other people can find us more easily. Tell your friends and send us any questions that you have. We're also on, as I've said before, Instagram, Facebook, and Susie's own website, which is susieasleymindfulness.co.uk. Until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye for now.